Chapter 2. Dust and Ashes.
I had been to Venice a dozen times or more, having fallen under its spell when I first caught sight of it 20 years before, a city of domes and bell towers floating hazily in the distance, topped here and there by a marble saint or a gilded angel. On this latest trip, as always, I made my approach by water taxi. The boat slowed as we drew near. Then it slipped into the shaded closeness of a small canal. Moving at an almost stately pace, we glided past overhanging balconies and weather-worn stone figures set into crumbling brick and stucco. I looked up through open windows and caught glimpses of painted ceilings and glass chandeliers. I heard fleeting bits of music and conversation, but no honking of horns, no squealing of brakes, and no motors other than the muffled churning of our own. People walked over footbridges as we passed underneath, and the backwash from our boat splashed on moss-covered steps leading down into the canal. That 20-minute boat ride had become a much-anticipated rite of passage, transporting me 3 miles across the lagoon and 500 to 1,000 years backward in time. To me, Venice was not merely beautiful. It was beautiful everywhere. On one occasion, I set about testing this notion by concocting a game called Photo Roulette, the object of which was to walk around the city taking photographs at unplanned moments, whenever a church bell rang, or at every sighting of a dog or cat, to see how often, standing at an arbitrary spot, one would be confronted by a view of exceptional beauty. The answer? Almost always. But irritatingly often, before taking a picture, I had to wait for a straggle of tourists to step out of the frame, even in the outlying quarters where tourists supposedly never went. This is why I decided to come to Venice in midwinter. I would see it without the obscuring overlay of other tourists. For once, I would have a clear view of Venice as a functioning city. The people I saw in the streets would be people who actually lived there, going about their business purposefully, casting familiar glances at sights that still had the power to stop me in my tracks. But as I came across the lagoon that morning in early February 1996 and caught the first faint whiff of charcoal, I realized I had arrived in Venice at an extraordinary moment. A stunning, full-color aerial photograph of Venice dominated the front page of the morning's Il Gazzettino. It was a panoramic view of the city taken the day after the fire, with the burned-out Fenice at the center of it, a faint plume of smoke rising from its blackened crater as if from a spent volcano. "Never again, no more pictures like this," the newspaper promised its readers. There had been an outpouring of sympathy for Venice. The opera singer Luciano Pavarotti had announced he would give a concert to help raise funds to rebuild the Fenice. Placido Domingo, not to be outdone, said he would also give a concert, but his concert would be in St. Mark's Basilica. Pavarotti shot back that he too would sing in St. Mark's and that he would sing there alone. Woody Allen, whose jazz band was to have reopened the newly renovated Fenice with a concert at the end of the month, quipped to a reporter that the fire must have been set by a lover of good music, adding, "If they didn't want me to play, all they had to do was say so." The destruction of the Fenice was an especially brutal loss for Venice. It had been one of the few cultural attractions that had not been ceded to outsiders. Venetians always outnumbered tourists at the Fenice, so all Venetians felt a special affection for it, even those who had never set foot inside the place. The city's prostitutes took up a collection and presented Mayor Cacciari with a check for $1,500. The Gazzettino reported on a series of revelations about the fire that had come out in the last 2 days. Even for people not normally susceptible to suggestions of conspiracy, there were a number of suspicious coincidences.